The Visit to the Museum. Several years ago, a friend of mine in Paris, a person with oddities, to put it mildly, learning that I was going to spend 2 or 3 days at Montissère, asked me to drop in at the local museum, where there hung, he was told, a portrait of his grandfather by Leroy. Smiling and spreading out his hands, he related a rather vague story, to which I confess I paid little attention, partly because I do not like other people's obtrusive affairs, but chiefly because I always had doubts about my friend's capacity to remain this side of fantasy. It went more or less as follows. After the grandfather died in their St. Petersburg house, back at the time of the Russo-Japanese War, the contents of his apartment in Paris were sold at auction. The portrait, after some obscure peregrinations, was acquired by the Museum of Leroy's native town. My friend wished to know if the portrait was really there. If there, if it could be ransomed. And if it could, for what price? When I asked why he did not get in touch with the museum, he replied that he had written several times, but had never received an answer. I made an inward resolution not to carry out the request. I could always tell him I had fallen ill or changed my itinerary. The very notion of seeing sights, whether they be museums or ancient buildings, is loathsome to me. Besides, the good freak's commission seemed absolute nonsense. It so happened, however, that while wandering about Montussert's empty streets in search of a stationery store, and cursing the spire of a long-necked cathedral, always the same one, that kept popping up at the end of every street, I was caught in a violent downpour, which immediately went about accelerating the fall of the maple leaves, for the fair weather of a southern October was holding on by a mere thread. I dashed for cover and found myself on the steps of the museum. It was a building of modest proportions, constructed of many-colored stones, with columns, a gilt inscription over the frescoes of the pediment, and a lion-legged stone bench on either side of the bronze door. One of its leaves stood open, and the interior seemed dark against the shimmer of the shower. I stood for a while on the steps, but despite the overhanging roof, they were gradually growing speckled. I saw that the rain had set in for good, and so, having nothing better to do, I decided to go inside. No sooner had I trod on the smooth, resonant flagstones of the vestibule than the clatter of a moved stool came from a distant corner, and the custodian, a banal pensioner with an empty sleeve, rose to meet me, laying aside his newspaper and peering at me over his spectacles. I paid my franc in trying not to look at some statues in the entrance, which were as traditional and insignificant as the first number in a circus program. I entered the main hall. Everything was as it should be. Gray tints, the sleep of substance, matter dematerialized. There was the usual case of old worn coins resting in the inclined velvet of their compartments. There was, on top of the case, a pair of owls, eagle owl and long-eared, with their French names reading Grand Duke and Middle Duke, if translated. Venerable minerals lay in their open graves of dusty papier-mâché. A photograph of an astonished gentleman with a pointed beard dominated an assortment of strange black lumps of various sizes. They bore a great resemblance to frozen frass, and I paused involuntarily over them, for I was quite at a loss to guess their nature, composition, and function. The custodian had been following me with felted steps, always keeping a respectful distance. Now, however, he came up, with one hand behind his back and the ghost of the other in his pocket, and gulping, if one judged by his Adam's apple. "What are they?" I asked. "Science has not yet determined," he replied, undoubtedly having learned the phrase by rote. "They were found," he continued in the same phony tone, "in 1895 by Louis Pradier, municipal councillor and Knight of the Legion of Honor," and his trembling finger indicated the photograph. "Well and good," I said. "But who decided and why that they merited a place in the museum?" "And now I call your attention to this skull," the old man cried energetically, obviously changing the subject. "Still, I would be interested to know what they are made of," I interrupted. "Science," he began anew, but stopped short and looked crossly at his fingers, which were soiled with dust from the glass. I proceeded to examine a Chinese vase, probably brought back by a naval officer, A group of porous fossils, a pale worm and clouded alcohol, a red and green map of Montserrat in the 17th century, and a trio of rusted tools bound by a funereal ribbon, a spade, a mattock, and a pick. To dig in the past, I thought, absent-mindedly, but this time did not seek clarification from the custodian who was following me noiselessly and meekly, weaving in and out among the display cases. Beyond the first hall there was another, apparently the last, and in its center a large sarcophagus stood like a dirty bathtub, while the walls were hung with paintings. At once my eye was caught by the portrait of a man between two abominable landscapes, with cattle and atmosphere. I moved closer and, to my considerable amazement, found the very object whose existence had hitherto seemed to me but the figment of an unstable mind. The man, depicted in wretched oils, wore a frock coat, whiskers, and a large pince-nez on a cord. He bore a likeness to Offenbach, but, in spite of the work's vile conventionality, I had the feeling one could make out in his features the horizon of a resemblance, as it were, to my friend. In one corner, meticulously traced in carmine against a black background, was the signature Le Roi, in a hand as commonplace as the work itself. I felt a vinegarish breath near my shoulder and turned to meet the custodian's kindly gaze. "Tell me," I asked, "supposing someone wished to buy one of these paintings, whom should he see?"
"The treasures of the museum are the pride of the city," replied the old man, "and pride is not for sale."
Fearing his eloquence, I hastily concurred, but nevertheless asked for the name of the museum's director. He tried to distract me with the story of the sarcophagus, but I insisted. Finally, he gave me the name of one Monsieur Godard, and explained where I could find him. Frankly, I enjoyed the thought that the portrait existed. It is fun to be present at the coming true of a dream, even if it is not one's own. I decided to settle the matter without delay. When I get in the spirit, no one can hold me back. I left the museum with a brisk, resonant step and found that the rain had stopped. Blueness had spread across the sky. A woman in bee-splattered stockings was spinning along on a silver-shining bicycle, and only over the surrounding hills did clouds still hang. Once again the cathedral began playing hide-and-seek with me, but I outwitted it. Barely escaping the onrushing tires of a furious red bus packed with singing youths, I crossed the asphalt thoroughfare, and a minute later was ringing at the garden gate of Monsieur Godard. He turned out to be a thin, middle-aged gentleman in high collar and dickey, with a pearl in the knot of his tie, and a face very much resembling a Russian wolfhound. As if that were not enough, he was licking his chops in a most dog-like manner, while sticking a stamp on an envelope. When I entered his small but lavishly furnished room with its malachite inkstand on the desk and a strangely familiar Chinese vase on the mantel, a pair of fencing foils hung crossed over the mirror which reflected the narrow gray back of his head. Here and there photographs of a warship pleasantly broke up the blue flora of the wallpaper.
"What can I do for you?"
he asked, throwing the letter he had just sealed into the wastebasket. This act seemed unusual to me. However, I did not see fit to interfere. I explained in brief my reason for coming, even naming the substantial sum with which my friend was willing to part, though he had asked me not to mention it, but wait instead for the museum's terms.
"Oh, this is delightful," said Monsieur Godard. "The only thing is, you are mistaken. There is no such picture in our museum."
"What do you mean there is no such picture? I have just seen it. Portrait of a Russian Nobleman by Gustave Le Roi."
"We do have one Le Roi," said Monsieur Godard when he had leafed through an oilcloth notebook and his black fingernail had stopped at the entry in question. "However, it is not a portrait but a rural landscape. The Return of the Herd."
I repeated that I had seen the picture with my own eyes 5 minutes before and that no power on earth could make me doubt its existence.
"Agreed," said Monsieur Godard. "But I am not crazy either. I have been curator of our museum for almost 20 years now and know this catalogue as well as I know the Lord's Prayer. It says here, Return of the Herd, and that means the herd is returning. And unless perhaps your friend's grandfather is depicted as a shepherd, I cannot conceive of his portrait's existence in our museum.
He is wearing a frock coat, I cried. I swear he is wearing a frock coat.
And how did you like our museum in general? Monsieur Godard asked suspiciously. Did you appreciate the sarcophagus?
Listen, I said, and I think there was already a tremor in my voice. Do me a favor. Let's go there this minute, and let's make an agreement that if the portrait is there, you will sell it.
And if not? Inquired Monsieur Godard.
I shall pay you the sum anyway.
All right, he said. Here, take this red and blue pencil, and using the red, please, put it in writing for me.
In my excitement, I carried out his demand. Upon glancing at my signature, he deplored the difficult pronunciation of Russian names. Then he appended his own signature, and quickly folding the sheet, thrust it into his waistcoat pocket.
Let's go, he said, freeing a cuff.
On the way, he stepped into a shop and bought a bag of sticky-looking caramels, which he began offering me insistently. When I flatly refused, he tried to shake out a couple of them into my hand. I pulled my hand away. Several caramels fell on the sidewalk. He stopped to pick them up and then overtook me at a trot. When we drew near the museum, we saw the red tourist bus, now empty, parked outside.
Aha, said Monsieur Godard, pleased. I see we have many visitors today.
He doffed his hat and, holding it in front of him, walked decorously up the steps. All was not well at the museum. From within issued rowdy cries, lewd laughter, and even what seemed like the sound of a scuffle. We entered the first hall. There the elderly custodian was restraining two sacrilegists who wore some kind of festive emblems in their lapels and were altogether very purple-faced and full of pep as they tried to extract the municipal councillor's merds from beneath the glass. The rest of the youths, members of some rural athletic organization, were making noisy fun, some of the worm and the alcohol, others of the skull. One joker was in rapture over the pipes of the steam radiator, which he pretended was an exhibit. Another was taking aim at an owl with his fist and forefinger. There were about 30 of them in all, and their motion and voices created a condition of crush and thick noise. Monsieur Godard clapped his hands and pointed at a sign reading, "Visitors to the museum must be decently attired." Then he pushed his way, with me following, into the second hall. The whole company immediately swarmed after us. I steered Godard to the portrait. He froze before it, chest inflated, and then stepped back a bit, as if admiring it, and his feminine heel trod on somebody's foot.
"Splendid picture," he exclaimed with genuine sincerity. "Well, let's not be petty about this. You were right, and there must be an error in the catalogue."
As he spoke, his fingers, moving as it were on their own, tore up our agreement into little bits which fell like snowflakes into a massive spittoon.
"Who's the old ape?"
asked an individual in a striped jersey, and, as my friend's grandfather was depicted holding a glowing cigar, another funster took out a cigarette and prepared to borrow a light from the portrait.
"All right, let us settle on the price," I said, "and in any case, let's get out of here." "Make way, please," shouted Monsieur Godard, pushing aside the curious.
There was an exit which I had not noticed previously at the end of the hall, and we thrust our way through to it.
"I can make no decision," Monsieur Godard was shouting above the din. "Decisiveness is a good thing only when supported by law. I must first discuss the matter with the mayor, who has just died and has not yet been elected. I doubt that you will be able to purchase the portrait, but nevertheless I would like to show you still other treasures of ours."
We found ourselves in a hall of considerable dimensions. Brown books, with a half-baked look and coarse, foxed pages, lay open under glass on a long table. Along the walls stood dummy soldiers in jackboots with flared tops.
"Come, let's talk it over," I cried out in desperation, trying to direct Monsieur Godard's evolutions to a plush-covered sofa in a corner.
But in this I was prevented by the custodian. Flailing his one arm, he came running after us, pursued by a merry crowd of youths, one of whom had put on his head a copper helmet with a Rembrandtesque gleam.
"Take it off! Take it off!" shouted Monsieur Godard.
and someone's shove made the helmet fly off the hooligan's head with a clatter. "Let us move on," said Monsieur Godard, tugging at my sleeve, and we passed into the section of ancient sculpture. I lost my way for a moment among some enormous marble legs, and twice ran around a giant knee before I again caught sight of Monsieur Godard, who was looking for me behind the white ankle of a neighboring giantess. Here a person in a bowler, who must have clambered up her, suddenly fell from a great height to the stone floor. One of his companions began helping him up, but they were both drunk, and, dismissing them with a wave of the hand, Monsieur Godard rushed on to the next room, radiant with oriental fabrics. There hounds raced across azure carpets, and a bow and quiver lay on a tiger skin. Strangely, though, the expanse and motley only gave me a feeling of oppressiveness and imprecision, and, perhaps because new visitors kept dashing by, or perhaps because I was impatient to leave the unnecessarily spreading museum and, amid calm and freedom, conclude my business negotiations with Monsieur Godard, I began to experience a vague sense of alarm. Meanwhile, we had transported ourselves into yet another hall, which must have been really enormous, judging by the fact that it housed the entire skeleton of a whale, resembling a frigate's frame, beyond which were visible still other halls, with the oblique sheen of large paintings full of storm clouds, among which floated the delicate idols of religious art in blue and pink vestments. And all this resolved itself in an abrupt turbulence of misty draperies, and chandeliers came aglitter, and fish with translucent frills meandered through illuminated aquariums. Racing up a staircase, we saw, from the gallery above, a crowd of gray-haired people with umbrellas examining a gigantic mock-up of the universe. At last, in a somber but magnificent room dedicated to the history of steam machines, I managed to halt my carefree guide for an instant. "Enough!" I shouted. "I'm leaving! We'll talk tomorrow!" He had already vanished. I turned and saw, scarcely an inch from me, the lofty wheels of a sweaty locomotive. For a long time I tried to find the way back among models of railroad stations. How strangely glowed the violet signals in the gloom beyond the fan of wet tracks, and what spasms shook my poor heart. Suddenly, everything changed again. In front of me stretched an infinitely long passage containing numerous office cabinets and elusive scurrying people. Taking a sharp turn, I found myself amid a thousand musical instruments. The walls, all mirror, reflected an enfilade of grand pianos, while in the center there was a pool with a bronze Orpheus atop a green rock. The aquatic theme did not end here, as, racing back, I ended up in the section of fountains and brooks, and it was difficult to walk along the winding, slimy edges of those waters. Now and then, on one side or the other, stone stairs with puddles on the steps, which gave me a strange sensation of fear, would descend into misty abysses, whence issued whistles, the rattle of dishes, the clatter of typewriters, the ring of hammers, and many other sounds, as if, down there, were exposition halls of some kind or another, already closing or not yet completed. Then I found myself in darkness, and kept bumping into unknown furniture, until I finally saw a red light and walked out onto a platform that clanged under me, and suddenly, beyond it, there was a bright parlor, tastefully furnished in Empire style, but not a living soul. Not a living soul. By now I was indescribably terrified, but every time I turned and tried to retrace my steps along the passages, I found myself in hitherto unseen places. A greenhouse with hydrangeas and broken window panes, with the darkness of artificial night showing through beyond, or a deserted laboratory with dusty alembics on its tables. Finally, I ran into a room of some sort with coat racks monstrously loaded down with black coats and astrakhan furs. From beyond a door came a burst of applause, but when I flung the door open, there was no theater, but only a soft opacity, and splendidly counterfeited fog with the perfectly convincing blotches of indistinct streetlights. More than convincing. I advanced, and immediately a joyous and unmistakable sensation of reality
at last replaced all the unreal trash amid which I had just been dashing to and fro. The stone beneath my feet was real sidewalk, powdered with wonderfully fragrant newly fallen snow, in which the infrequent pedestrians had already left fresh black tracks. At first the quiet and the snowy coolness of the night, somehow strikingly familiar, gave me a pleasant feeling after my feverish wanderings. Trustfully, I started to conjecture just where I had come out, and why the snow, and what were those lights exaggeratedly but indistinctly beaming here and there in the brown darkness. I examined, and, stooping, even touched a round spur stone on the curb, then glanced at the palm of my hand, full of wet, granular cold, as if hoping to read an explanation there. I felt how lightly, how naively I was clothed, but the distinct realization that I had escaped from the museum's maze was still so strong that, for the first 2 or 3 minutes, I experienced neither surprise nor fear. Continuing my leisurely examination, I looked up at the house beside which I was standing, and was immediately struck by the sight of iron steps and railings that descended into the snow on their way to the cellar. There was a twinge in my heart, and it was with a new alarmed curiosity that I glanced at the pavement, at its white cover along which stretched black lines, at the brown sky across which there kept sweeping a mysterious light, and at the massive parapet some distance away. I sensed that there was a drop beyond it. Something was creaking and gurgling down there. Further on, beyond the murky cavity, stretched a chain of fuzzy lights. Scuffling along the snow in my soaked shoes, I walked a few paces, all the time glancing at the dark house on my right. Only in a single window did a lamp glow softly under its green glass shade. Here, a locked wooden gate. There, what must be the shutters of a sleeping shop. And by the light of a street lamp whose shape had long been shouting to me its impossible message, I made out the ending of a sign, Inca Sapog. Ooh, repair. But no, it was not the snow that had obliterated the hard sign at the end. No, no, in a minute I shall wake up, I said aloud, and trembling, my heart pounding, I turned and walked on. Stopped again. From somewhere came the receding sound of hooves. The snow sat like a skullcap on a slightly leaning spur stone, and indistinctly showed white on the woodpile on the other side of the fence, and already I knew irrevocably where I was. Alas, it was not the Russia I remembered, but the factual Russia of today, forbidden to me, hopelessly slavish and hopelessly my own native land. A semi-phantom in a light foreign suit, I stood on the impassive snow of an October night somewhere on the Moika or the Fontanka Canal, or perhaps on the Obvodny, and I had to do something, go somewhere, run, desperately protect my fragile, illegal life. Oh, how many times in my sleep had I experienced a similar sensation, though now it was reality. Everything was real. The air that seemed to mingle with scattered snowflakes, the still unfrozen canal, the floating fish house, and that peculiar squareness of the darkened and the yellow windows. A man in a fur cap with a briefcase under his arm came toward me out of the fog, gave me a startled glance, and turned to look again when he had passed me. I waited for him to disappear, and then, with a tremendous haste, began pulling out everything I had in my pockets, ripping up papers, throwing them into the snow, and stamping them down. There were some documents, a letter from my sister in Paris, 500 francs, a handkerchief, cigarettes. However, in order to shed all the integument of my exile, I would have to tear off and destroy my clothes, my linen, my shoes, everything, and remain ideally naked. And even though I was already shivering from my anguish and from the cold, I did what I could. But enough. I shall not recount how I was arrested, nor tell of my subsequent ordeals. Suffice it to say that it cost me incredible patience and effort to get back abroad, and that, ever since, I have forsworn carrying out commissions entrusted one by the insanity of others.